I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Hello and welcome to the Fried Egg Podcast. My name is Garrett Morrison, and today we're talking about how and why country club life started in America. So the US Open is at the country club in Brookline this week, and Brookline is often said to be the nation's first country club. Now, I'm not sure how accurate that claim is, but it was definitely one of the first. It's been active since the early 1880s, and it's offered golf since the early 1890s. Before that period, there just weren't many places like it in America. By the end of the 1800s, though, it was a different story. The 1890s in particular saw an explosion of golf-focused clubs in the US. And I've often wondered why this happened then. Why was it that about 130 years ago, Americans suddenly wanted to go out and form country clubs and play golf? Well, the best answers to that question that I've found are in a book called Golf and the American Country Club, which was written about 15 years ago by Richard J. Moss.
But believe it or not, everybody calls me Pete. Yeah, I taught college history for almost 40 years, mostly in Maine at Colby College.
Pete has also written other books, including The Kingdom of Golf in America and Eden in the Pines, A History of Pinehurst Village, both terrific as well. But in Golf and the American Country Club, Pete gives his most concise argument as to why places like the Country Club in Brookline came about. And basically, he says it had a lot to do with big changes that were happening throughout the country in the late 1800s, the late Victorian period, as we'll call it. The cities were getting bigger and more hectic, corporations were becoming more powerful, immigration was increasing, and essentially many middle to upper class people in America wanted to get away. These people included what would become known as the Apple Tree Gang. That's where Pete and I pick up in our conversation, and just as an FYI, we recorded this about a year ago for a bigger project that never quite came together, and so there are some references to COVID times that thankfully were more relevant then than they are now. All right, let's get to it. So I know that you did most of your research years ago on this, but I was wondering if we could start by talking about the Apple Tree Gang, who they were and what they did.
You know, all I think of when I think about the Apple Tree Gang is that they were Scots for the most part, and they very often had some connections and went back to Scotland, and they wanted to play golf in America. And they started out really crudely. I think that's the main thing. I mean, they started out playing in an apple orchard. You know, when I think about clubs, I always think about some sort of development that everybody thinks that these clubs are you know, born in one day. And the next thing, you know, one day you don't have Pebble Beach and the next day you do. The clubs in the 80s, the first clubs in the 80s and the 90s were really... There's really no word for how simple they really were. I mean, the reality is they often rented land. That was sort of how that's the indication of how tentative they approached this. And you know, as personalities, they were upper middle class suburban New Yorkers, and they got together. They were friends, and they played on in a very crude fashion. Then the next thing you know, they bought some land, and the next thing you know, it was St. Andrews of Yonkers, you know. And the history of the clubs from that period are very often like that. Even if the people were very wealthy and could afford to just, you know, go whole hog and buy land and get a designer and do that. But that wasn't the case. There was very modest investments you know, it was a new game. It was sort of tentative. They didn't know if they could get a membership. I mean, that varied, of course. I mean, I think there were, you know, there are places that were sort of born, you know, whole hog out of something else. I think Brookline was to be all about horses at one point.
Right.
And it wasn't. And then, you know, golf sort of crept in and it's not about horses at all anymore.
And so when you talk about a group like the Apple Tree Gang, literally at the beginning, they're playing in an apple orchard.
Right. And rented land, I think, from a butcher, if I'm not mistaken.
And so tell me about the style of golf that they would play in a...
That's just really hard to imagine. I mean, I think it's more... It certainly isn't about whacking the ball large distances.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more... You know, it's a game of sort of gigantic croquet. Instead of wickets, you have a hole. And, you know, you're not hitting the ball very far. You're not playing in any sort of pristine conditions. You can only imagine how bad the greens were. You know, I mean, the greens were probably just, you know, mown circles, especially on the early municipal courses. They would just go out and, you know, 280 yards and mow a circle, and then go 300 yards and mow a circle, and then they would go 120 yards and mow a circle. I mean, it was just... There was a process of refinement that was incredibly long, from something I've just tried to describe to, you know, the perfect golf courses now, you know, the perfected golf courses that we have that are, you know, unbelievably refined places that a lot of money has been lavished upon. But the early ones were really cheap. Nobody wanted to really make any much of an investment, and it all grew from that.
Taking a step back, taking a wider view here for a second, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the kind of cultural mood in the late 1800s, and specifically the factors in American culture that led to the rise of the golf-focused country club. What were kind of those impulses that drove people to want to participate in something like this?
Well, I think there were a number of them, and they're sort of, it's hard to arrange it by importance. But health was an important one. That the cities of the late 19th century were pretty ghastly places. Again, hard for us to imagine. Their disease was much more common. And there was certainly the idea that you wanted to participate, horses and carriages and stuff. There are all kinds of subtle influences, but it was also, and a lot of historians have talked about this, it was a time when everybody was forming clubs for everything. There was a lot of, and a lot of associations. One, I think that somebody's used the phrase an era of associations. I think the bar associations all are formed. The American Medical Association is formed during this period. All kinds of, I think the Boy Scouts were formed during this period. And there was the idea that you could improve your life by being in these associations. They could provide clubhouses and they could provide events. One suspects they could provide romance. Men and women met one another. And if you look at individual towns, I know that a student of mine wrote a really good paper on Waterville, Maine, and it was just chock-a-block with organizations.
So I'd like to maybe explore a few other factors that you talked about in your book as well. I can prompt you on some of these. You refer to the promotion of mental and physical health that golf and the country club offered. Could you tell me a little bit about the about late Victorian anxiety and depression?
Yeah, well, they called it neurasthenia, and it's oddly something we recognize.
Oh yes,
in ourselves that there's something about modern mechanized, urbanized, suburbanized society that doesn't do us any good. I mean, to say it makes us sick is sort of dramatic. You know, there are people who will say that. And the involvement in something outside, and particularly, this is going to be a new term from that I've thought about since I wrote anything about golf, called skilled practices. Taking up a skilled practice. So two of the, that you might want to, well, tennis is obviously one. Golf is obviously one. Fly fishing is one that has been much butted about lately. And that a skilled practice outside is good for you. It takes you away from the concerns of your job or the concerns of your family or the rush and pell-mell of cities and makes you focus on learning how to hit a six iron straight or a backhand or, you know, how to keep your fly line out of the bushes. You know, having that outside of your economic life and your social life is good for your mental health.
On another note, so there's the mental health piece, which I think a lot of people will recognize now. That's the big word on golf at the moment. We're all feeling cooped up, and you know, I sort of recognize that in these late 19th century Victorians, they were feeling kind of cooped up in their houses as the cities were growing around them. I wonder if you could also talk about the decline in what people perceived as the traditional order in this era, and how that factored into the rise of the country club.
Yeah, I think that that's really hard to, I mean, I recognize that, you know, it was happening. And I think maybe the best place to see that is in gender. The whole idea that women should, you know, be domestic and stay at home, and that it was actually bad for them. It was prescribed in the late 19th century that, you know, the first prescription for neurasthenia was to go home and be very calm, set in your room. And, you know, we have a lot of both fiction and nonfiction testifying to the fact that women were defined that way. And it's really interesting that in 25 or 30 years, the idea that they should be out and about and play golf, and people put a lot of emphasis on the limits that were imposed on women in golf. I think it's just as important that they were playing at all and that they were involved in it. I think it's crystal clear to me when I read all about all these clubs that while they may not have played the game as much as men did, they certainly were dominant in the clubhouse. The social life was certainly not something that women shied away from. And they, you know, they were part of the whole thing. But they also played, certainly. You know, the USGA had tournaments for them, and there were, you know, there were women playing. And by the 20s, there were really good women playing.
So this was a change in the social order that the country club seems in many ways to support, or to even be a driver for, even as the country club did distinguish the genders and keep them apart in some ways. It also gave the quote unquote new woman an outlet for kind of physical activity and social activity.
I mean, you certainly have one-offs that are kind of important, Marion Hollins being one. I mean, Marion Hollins now is everywhere. It is a fascinating story, but it's just a one-off. You know, a rich girl, her father loses all her money, so she goes out and becomes rich herself. And, you know, she plays virtually every sport. And, you know, I think horses and tennis and golf being the three major ones. And then she goes to California, strikes oil, literally, and then builds Pasatiempo, has something to do with Cypress Point. And I think the evidence is pretty clear. She had something to do with Augusta.
Yes.
And so, you know, that's just a one-off. And I think she's certainly gay. I think, you know, that didn't seem to inhibit her in any ways. Not to suggest that, you know, there wasn't a vicious bias against gay in general, but certainly you can see that this club life had room for that, or at least certain varieties of that club life were a lot more tolerant maybe than the general society. But Marion Hollins is at least one piece of evidence of that.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Gooder. Nothing kicks off summer quite like the U.S. Open, and we're here this week at Brookline, and one of the things that I made sure to pack was my pair of Gooders. These are great sunglasses. They are polarized lenses. They have golf-specific lenses. They are non-slip, and best of all, they carry a relatively reasonable price point. So the nice thing about this is you can mix and match. You can get a bunch of different styles, and they are high-quality sunglasses. You know, the same type of quality you're going to get from an expensive pair, but for an affordable rate. If you use the promo code TFE, you will get 15% off your entire order at Gooder.com. That's Goodr.com. And use the promo code TFE at checkout for 15% off your order.
Okay, so we have the gender narrative here, which is incredibly interesting. Something that seems to have certainly been breaking down in the late 19th century, and that the club seems to be an attempt at a kind of bastion against, is the decline of local control. And this might be kind of hard to define exactly, but the decline of that sense that, you know, people who lived in a particular place were controlling their lives, and the invasion of the national and the international and the corporate into people's local lives. Could you talk about that a little bit, and how the country club responded to it?
Here's the deal. I think you just did.
Sorry. That's my tendency when I ask questions sometimes.
No, that's the perfect, and certainly, you know, if we think about the iconic clubs, that doesn't come through. But when you come through with the idea, and I tried to find one, I think I found there's all kinds of them from, say, 1905 to 1930. I mean, every small town, and I don't mean village, but I mean, you know, with a substantial base of lawyers and doctors and middle-class people, wanted to have their own club. And I think one of the reasons they wanted to have their own club was just exactly for this local control deal, this local control feeling. And you're absolutely right. This is a time when corporations, national corporations, are taking over national transportation, railroads. Certainly historians have generally accepted that as a theme for the period, 1880 to 1930. That in that 50-year period, you know, we went from a time when, you know, you probably met the same people and dealt with them economically on the streets of where you lived every day. And by the end of the period, you didn't do that anymore, ever. You worked for a big corporation. The stores that sold you food weren't run by, you know, a guy you knew, or owned by a guy you knew. They were owned by a big corporation. Everything, and there's a famous book called The Incorporation of America. I'm trying to think of who wrote that.
Alan Trachtenberg.
Yeah, Alan Trachtenberg. And, you know, I mean, it's all detailed in there. And, you know, the LLC, funny, I just talked to a guy on the phone the other day, was doing a work on the idea that the rise of the LLC, the limited liability corporation, the corporation, was the singular most important fact in American history. That it's the structural outline of life in America. And, you know, he's got a point. And I think the Gundy Club was an attempt to assert or create a place where local people stayed in control. They made an investment, and they ran it their way, and it became a matter of local pride. You know, it became almost, I think one of the things was that there was a sort of civic pride element to a lot of small local clubs, that if you had one, you were kind of on the map as a real city, as a real town. And to some degree, people use those as to draw tourism. Mm-hmm.
So you say that the country club in this vein was an attempt to recreate the long lost, you know, maybe not completely real, but somehow culturally remembered village.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you don't literally mean that the country clubs were designed as villages. So what do you mean when you say that the country club tried to recreate that?
It's first of all, it's just a matter of size. It's a matter of having a community the size of which you determine. How big is your club going to be? Is it going to be 300 or 3,000 or whatever? And it's also limited in space and scope. You know, people say, well, you know, that's kind of a weird idea. And I said, well, why did Jack Nicklaus call his place Muirfield Village? It's not a village. It's a massive, you know, golf project with suburban houses attached. You know, this gets even weirder. You know, I mean, why is Greenwich Village called Greenwich Village? That doesn't make a lot of sense unless just the word village means a lot to people. It means something smaller, something more intimate, something limited in scope, something not particularly dynamic in terms of forging into the future and, you know, changing things, that it's a commitment to traditionalism. And, you know, so it's a really, I mean, the village word gets used a lot for things that really aren't villages. There's a weird psychological phenomenon going on there. And the only thing I've ever said is it's a sort of commitment to traditionalism, a commitment to stability, you know, and the idea that this isn't a dynamic urban place.
And an attempt to create tradition out of thin air.
Right. Out of names.
Yeah. Instant tradition, which is so American. Another piece of this seems to be the rise of immigration in the late 1800s from Eastern and Southern European countries, as well as from Latin America, and the desire to create a more racially homogenous zone away from the city. Would you say this was an important factor, and could you talk about it little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are two things, and it's ethno-religious, and that I think the conflicts are as much a Protestant leadership class trying to have a space without Jews or Catholics, and in a much smaller sense, Catholics and Jews trying to have some spaces without Protestants. But the conflict, particularly between Protestants and Jews, was ferocious. I mean, in the Pinehurst books, I mean, I ran across they had a program. I was going to say massive, but a very substantial program to keep Jews out of the hotels from ever coming here. And then the deeds here forbid anyone to sell land to Jews or obviously African Americans or Indians. And so the idea of creating these sort of free of Jewish influences and free from Jews by Protestants was a tremendous factor in big projects like Pinehurst and smaller country clubs everywhere. Vance Packard actually came up with a couple of examples from his research that I used where Jews were perfectly integrated in the town. They did business with one another because they simply had to. And then when the Protestants created a country club, they excluded them all. They refused to have memberships, which he thought was a real important sort of thing, that these new inventions like country clubs kind of reinvigorated the conflicts.
So do you think that these, we could use the term racially homogenous or ethno-religiously homogenous clubs, do you think they're in some ways a direct response to rising integration in the other spheres of society?
Oh, yeah. Oh, did you say integration or immigration?
Well, I guess both. I did say integration.
Yeah.
As in, so, you know, there was this really thorough attempt to try to keep Jewish people out of Protestant clubs, while at the same time, in many ways, Jewish people were making inroads in society and politics.
No, I think that's true. And I think it's true of, I think the sharp lines between Catholics and Protestants blurred a lot. And I think, obviously, one of the secrets here is intermarriage. You know, and I think the statistics show that, you know, the 20th century intermarriage between the three main religions has gone up pretty steadily. It used to be a big issue, and it just, you know, well, it still is to some extent, I think, but it isn't like it used to be, where the three groups are sort of hermetically sealed off from one another. You know, certainly a whole different world in 1921 when you were putting a club together. You know, I mean, the assumption was you just wouldn't have Jews or Catholics. And in some few cases, you know, Jews made clubs for Jews, and there were a few Catholic clubs. There were even a few black clubs. You know, it gets complicated with a lot of forces. But I think you're probably right that integration in a larger society led inexorably kind of hard. You know, and in our own time, you know, I mean, it took Augusta 70 years to finally, you know, and then I think the gender issue is a separate issue. You know, I think there are all male clubs left, but you'd be hard pressed to name them. They don't have a very high profile.
In fact, intentionally keep a lower profile. They want to stay out of the public discourse because they saw what happened with Shoal Creek and Augusta. But so, you know, so that's one aspect of the club's purpose, and one that perhaps has not aged well or not had a great impact on either golf or American society. But the other part of the club's purpose as a place for golf is more appealing. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. You know, it's surely part of the reason for the rise of the country club in the late 19th century and early 20th century is simply the appeal of golf as a game, and specifically the appeal of golf as a game to Americans. So what was it about golf?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is it was Scottish. Now, whether it was or not, you know, you can get an argument, but Scottish were just deemed to be acceptable. Then I think it had the allure that anybody could play the game, that you didn't have to be a big male, you didn't have to be fast. And I think it was, I think it really good question is it benefits a little bit from being totally nonviolent. And I've played golf for 70 years. I doubt you could tell me a sport that I could play for 70 years. I'm certainly not going to play football for 70 years, or baseball or basketball or hockey, for God's sakes. But I've played golf quite successfully, and it's gotten me out, and it's been very satisfying to me. I think that's a big thing, you know, and in an odd way, it's democratic physically. You know, the game's accessible physically. Actually, I read a book the other day, and it was really weird. And he talked about the fact that, well, what happens when people come up and they want to learn a sport in America? Most sports humiliate you in the beginning. I mean, you know, the first time you go out to play tennis, I mean, it's humiliating. And golf maybe might not be so humiliating because everybody is humiliated. It also has a set way of teaching the game that's pretty good in comparison to other games. You know, and the club was perfect for that. The club was a way in which you could go learn the game, keeping the humiliation down to a minimum. You could do it kind of in private, and then until you could, you know, actually really play, you could, you know, kind of work on it. But golf had a lot of benefits compared to the other sports that you might have taken up at the time. You know, it's a cliche, but it is a lifelong sport.
And one of the funny things that I learned in reading your book is that compared to many other upper-class leisure pursuits, golf was in fact quite cheap. And so that's another way in which it was democratic, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think that the municipal courses very often were free, the early ones. You know, I think the idea that it's expensive is just simply looking at you know, the Cypress points and the Augustas and the vast sums of money. And I mean, so that's where that comes from. But early on, I grew up in Jackson, Michigan. I don't know if that rings any bells to you, but it was a real golfy town. They had two municipal golf courses that were really inside the town limits. And when I was young, my mother used to give me 50 cents and drive me out to El Sharp Park. She'd slow down to about 5 miles an hour and push me out of the car and tell me that she'd be back at about 5:30 to pick me up. And, you know, I would go give my 50 cents and I would just play and play and play and play and play all day long. So, it, I guess the way to put it is it can be cheap and it has been cheap. The idea that it's through and through a game only for rich men is just, you know, not the case.
So the last subject I wanted to talk about to get us back to 100 years ago, was just a kind of general sketch of how country clubs took on complexity between the 1890s and the beginning of the Depression. So, you know, in your book, you refer to this as a process of gathering kind of complexity. What do you mean by complexity when it comes to country clubs?
There was a lot of stuff done with grass. Grass just became more sophisticated. The United States Department of Agriculture even got into the business of and there was, I forget how it all worked, but there was breeding, crossbreeding of grass, especially for golf courses. The search for the perfect green grass, putting green grass, that took place in a variety of ways depending on climate. So people began to spend a lot more on greens. They began to spend a lot more on fairways and grass. I mean, as you know, Crump went broke putting in Pine Valley, and a lot of it was problems with grass. And then I think clubs became better. Good question is, when did steel shafts actually begin to change the game? But complexity goes back, in my view, number one thing was the ball, and that was the invention of the wound ball. You could legitimately, with a gutta percha ball, have a legitimate 4,500-yard golf course, and that would be fine, because children and women couldn't hit the ball very far and really couldn't play very much. And the wound ball seemed to me to have changed a lot. It made the distances of the game roughly equivalent to what we have today, though, you know, we have our problems with that. But the big jump was in the early, right, was it 1901, 1902, when they first began to appear, and that changed the game. And so people had to build longer, more sophisticated courses to respond to that. And the clubs became more complex for another reason. And I'm cutting to the number one things here, and I think it was the acceptance of debt.
Hmm.
This tentative quality that I talked about in the 1880s and 1890s, where you rented some land and your apple tree gang or you put in a few holes and you gave it a try. You went into the thing now where you collected a couple of hundred people and you collected some money and you went out and you made a down payment on 400 acres of land, and you promised people who gave you the money that you were going to build a clubhouse, and the money that had been borrowed would be paid for by dues over, you know, this is a perpetual institution and so on. And it's really clear to me, and actually in this article that I will send you in the International Journal of Sport, I lay out how in the 20s, particularly, the acceptance of debt, which had been seen as only what con men and other such people, they're, you know, and debt comes to American life in lots of ways. People tend to buy their cars by the late 20s with car loans, auto loans, and so on. And the clubs used debt very creatively to get going. The idea here was you could get it instead of, you know, you could get a club together. If you get 300 people signed on a dotted line, you know, you could get into the club, build the course, build a clubhouse, and, you know, you had the dues to pay it off with. And that is a lot more complex. And that's really the pattern that you get an unbelievable rush of golf courses between 1922 and 1930. It's really incredible. It's really incredible.
Yeah. And all the old courses were renovated in that time as well.
Yeah, and a lot of people who had built a course in a city, in a smaller city or whatever, sold out, took the money, spent it on a down payment on a big patch of land in the suburbs. But you have a lot of clubs that their initial format, very modest in the city, very often 9 holes, modest clubhouse, sold that at a big profit and moved out into the suburbs.
Hmm. Well, this frame for understanding this part of golf history is that it may surprise you, but it actually could be quite provocative for certain aficionados of golf course architecture who, for many legitimate reasons, lionized the 20s as the golden age of golf course architecture. And I'm among those. I mean, I love those courses, the ones that survive. But, you know, the story that you're telling here is almost like the dot-com bubble or the housing bubble, where these clubs really got deep into debt in an attempt to get bigger and more complex, and it came back and bit them.
Then they got wiped out in the 30s.
Right.
The ones that plunged too far got wiped out, and we don't even know about them anymore. The cities expanded and just overran them, and the ones that were, you know, had the wherewithal to deal with the debt over time, you know, survived and became icons. But the decline in the number of private clubs between, say, 1932 and 1948. Yeah, 15 years of depression and war, and it was just murder. And if you were left out and you had too much debt and you started to lose your membership, I mean, St. Andrews, for example, the Yonkers St. Andrews, they were really in trouble. They just didn't have the membership to pay the debt. And they, you know, end up, I forget exactly all the things they do, but I know that they hired Nicholas to come in and redo the whole thing. And part of the deal was he got some land to build some houses on. But there are a lot of places where people managed to have kept the, you know, invidious social influences to a bare minimum and put golf forward as and we're collectively making the best course we can make for us to play on. And that's it. And that's good. I have no problem with it. I think that's, you know, I think that's a great part of American sport life, and which is not doing that well. The one thing I've been doing there is trucking in statistics about sedentary Americans. We don't even have jobs anymore where we stand up. Everybody's sitting down. Kids sit down in school more. You know, you sit down on your job, you know, there's some statistics that suggest that there are 25 to 30% of adult Americans who don't do any physical activity whatsoever. And, you know, golf is a good way to, I know it's kept me active. You know, I'm 77 years old and I'm reasonably healthy, and I still go out and walk around a golf course, and it keeps me going.
So just a couple of quick thoughts here. Part of what I took away from this interview was that there's a light side and a dark side to the beginnings of country club life in America. The positive legacy is that these clubs were about mental and physical health. Going outside, moving, and playing what I think is the most wonderful, beautiful game ever invented. That's good, obviously. That's something that the early country clubs wanted to cultivate, and it's good. The less wholesome part of it is that most of the clubs were exclusionary, racially, religiously, socioeconomically. And in fact, many country clubs were explicitly meant to be spaces apart from the modern world. They were meant to be an escape from diversity. So I guess when we think about the future of golf and country club life in America, all we can really do is look to the past and consider what's worth preserving and what we need to leave behind. All right, that's it. Make sure to check out the Father's Day sale in the Fried Egg Pro Shop. That's proshop.thefriedegg.com. 15% off everything except for photography. Lots of good deals in there. Enjoy the rest of the US Open at the Country Club. And thank you for listening.